The headlines this hour. Iran says its ambassador to Yemen has passed away due to COVID complications because certain countries delayed his return home for medical treatment. Iran's foreign minister is calling for a boost to international aid efforts for Afghanistan, hoping that it would stop the inflow of refugees. And New Zealand shelves plans for the reopening of its borders over concerns that the Omicron COVID variant is spreading fast across the globe. Thanks for joining us. The Iranian foreign minister says that his country does not have the capacity to provide additional services to incoming Afghan refugees. According to Hossein Amir Abdullahian, more than 500,000 Afghan students are enjoying free education in Iran. He said that authorities have been vaccinating Afghan refugees and Iranian nationals alike against COVID-19. He noted that the United Nations aid for Afghan asylum seekers is too small compared to what Iran has provided for them. Amir Abdullahian made the comments in a meeting with the UN's Visiting High Commissioner for Refugees. He called on the international community to help improve the humanitarian situation in Afghanistan in order to stop the flow of refugees. Thousands of Afghans have been crossing into Iran on a daily basis since the Taliban took over the country in August. We've spoken to political commentator E. Michael Jones about Afghanistan's refugee crisis. He says that the United Nations has done nothing to protect Afghans seeking refuge in Iran.
The wave of refugees is not something positive. I mean, God bless the Iranians for helping these people out. But this doesn't change the fact that they should remain in Afghanistan. Someone should take care of the situation in Afghanistan. Apparently, the United Nations is not doing it that well. We're living through an era where migration is being weaponized. It's being weaponized against Europe. It's being weaponized on the southern border against the United States by people within the United States. The Democratic Party favors this type of unlimited migration. This is an exceptional circumstance that needs to be corrected by having the people go back to where they came from. This is not, the Iranians should be working to get these people back to Afghanistan, doing whatever they can to do that.
Iran's ambassador to Yemen's National Salvation Government, Hassan Irlou, has passed away. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says that Irlou passed away this morning due to complications from COVID-19. He says that the envoy was transferred to Iran in poor health conditions because certain countries delayed his flight out of Sana'a. Khatibzadeh did not name any specific country, but Saudi Arabia and its allies in the war have kept Yemen under a blockade since 2015. Yemen's main airport in Sana'a has been closed for more than 5 years. Irlou was finally transferred to a hospital in Tehran 2 days ago. He became Iran's ambassador to Yemen's National Salvation Government last year. He was a veteran of the Iran-Iraq War and had been suffering from complications of chemical attacks. Yemen's Ansarullah movement has expressed its condolences to Tehran. Saudi warplanes carry out 3 airstrikes on Sana'a International Airport as the kingdom intensifies its war in Yemen. Yemen's Civil Aviation Authority says the strikes have disrupted services at the airport. It says that there has been a halt to the delivery of humanitarian aid supplies following the air raids. The airport was targeted hours after Saudi warplanes reportedly carried out around 40 airstrikes across the provinces of Jowf and Marib. Riyadh, along with some of its regional allies, launched a devastating war against a southern neighbor in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed in the onslaught. Iran condemns the Israeli aggression against Syria and calls on the UN Security Council to help end the occupation of Syria's Golan Heights.
We strongly condemn all aggressions of the Israeli regime against Syria and reaffirm Syria's inherent right to self-defense and to respond at the time and place of its choosing. The Security Council must compel the Israeli regime to end the occupation of the Syrian Golan and also stop immediately its aggressions against Syria.
Iran's deputy ambassador to the UN also called for an end to illegal foreign military presence on Syrian soil. Zahra Ershadi said the presence of uninvited forces is a violation of international law and the UN Charter. While urging the withdrawal of American forces from the crisis-hit Arab country, the Iranian diplomat condemned their attacks on Syrian civilians. Elsewhere in her remarks, Ershadi highlighted the deteriorating humanitarian situation in Syria. She underlined that sanctions imposed on the Arab country are hampering the work of international and local humanitarian agencies there. Investigative journalist Rick Sterling says that Lebanon is also a victim of Israeli aggression, as the regime violates its airspace to launch attacks against Syria.
Unfortunately, that's right. What we've seen happen is the UN Charter being trampled on. And this is one good example. Another example is on the Israeli aggression against Syria. And it was interesting to see over the weekend, Lebanese President General Aoun was very vocally condemning the Israeli attacks, the air attacks on Syria, because it's a violation of Lebanese airspace. So Israel is violating not just the rights of not just one country, but two countries in these actions. But it's very good to see what took place a few months ago at the UN General Assembly, where a new group was formed. It's called the Group of Friends in Defense of the Charter of the United Nations. And many countries have joined this grouping, which is going to try to reverse that trend and that trampling of the UN Charter and to start to reestablish it.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps are holding the second day of large-scale military drills in the south of the country. The IRGC naval forces successfully fired anti-ship cruise missiles and managed to destroy mock enemy's vessels. Forces also destroyed fixed and mobile targets by assault drones. The five-day maneuvers, codenamed the Great Prophet 17, are underway in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz regions, as well as the coasts of Hormuzgan, Bushehr, and Khuzestan provinces. The drills involve a variety of the IRGC's units. Iran regularly holds military drills to enhance the armed forces' combat readiness. In the U.S., health officials say Omicron now accounts for around three-quarters of COVID-19 cases in the country. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the new strain makes up over 95% of the new COVID cases in three Northwest states. Separately, the World Health Organization has warned that there is consistent evidence that Omicron is spreading a lot faster than previous variants and causing infections even in vaccinated people. Concerns over highly contagious Omicron have prompted several European countries to tighten lockdown measures and to toughen border controls to stem the spread of the strain. Germany has announced tougher restrictions on arrivals from the UK, requiring all British travelers to have a negative test result or undergo a two-week quarantine upon entry. Meanwhile, the rapid spread of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus is affecting the year-end holiday plans around the world. In the latest development, New Zealand says that its borders will remain closed for longer than expected. The country was just about to ease some of its tough cross-border restrictions, but it's now postponed until the end of February. Officials say the government needed a precautionary measure against the most transmissible COVID variant yet. Air New Zealand says the postponements of reopening plans will affect more than 27,000 customers. So far, 22 people in the Pacific nation have been infected with Omicron. But there have been no reports of community transmissions as of yet. New Zealand has one of the toughest COVID-related restrictions in the world. Russia and the United States have just started their discussions on the security guarantees that Moscow is seeking against NATO's eastward expansion. Senior security negotiator Konstantin Gavrilov says an understanding between Moscow and Washington on the issue is possible. Moscow is demanding written guarantees that NATO will not expand further east in former Soviet republics. Russia has also massed military equipment at the border with Ukraine. but it says the purpose is defensive amid Ukraine's push to join NATO. Earlier, we were joined by author and researcher Greg Simmons. He cast doubt on the possibility of Russia reaching a meaningful agreement with the U.S. and NATO on existing security concerns.
There's no point in looking at the issue that NATO and the U.S. are separate. The U.S. calls the shots in NATO, and they have been continually violating promises stemming from the promise to Gorbachev, which Matlock, the former ambassador to the USSR, has stated on many occasions. And if we look at it contemporarily, US promises and guarantees and even signed treaties and negotiations mean nothing. I mean, Iran knows this with the JCPOA, the different nuclear treaties which have been violated by the United States unilaterally. So these are worthless, and I doubt that they will actually make any agreement.
Chileans hit the streets to celebrate the victory of leftist Gabriel Boric against his far-right opponent in the country's presidential runoff. Tens of thousands of Boric's supporters celebrated his win in the capital, Santiago, and other cities. The 35-year-old former protest leader secured nearly 56% of the votes to become Chile's youngest president. He took a 12-point lead over far-right populist José Antonio Kast. Boric and Kast emerged as the two leading contenders after none of the seven candidates secured more than 50% in the first round last month. Kast has conceded defeat and congratulated Boric on his, quote, great triumph. Speaking to his supporters, the president-elect pledged to expand social rights and to govern with fiscal responsibility.
We're going to expand social rights, and we will do it with fiscal responsibility. We will do it while taking care of our macroeconomy. We will do it well, and that will allow us to improve pensions and health without having to go backwards afterwards. And we will have a balanced Congress that is already a reality, which means both an invitation and an obligation to dialogue.
Boric will be sworn in for a 4-year term starting from March of next year. He will be dealing with some of Chile's big challenges, including high inflation, the coronavirus pandemic, and social unrest. Chile has been rocked by massive protests against inequality and corruption in recent years. Boric will also be in power for the approval of a new constitution that is in the process of drafting. Commentator Tim Anderson says the victory of leftist Gabriel Boric in Chile's presidential runoff marks a shift from the country's past, largely defined by Pinochet and his dictatorship.
Gabriel Boric is one of the generation of student leaders from about a decade ago. He's from the far south of Chile, and he's been in parliament for 2 terms as a member of parliament. And this his election victory now is a very important break from the past, particularly because his opponent was very specifically aligned with the Pinochet past. And as you said in the introduction, he's going to preside over next year the implementation of a new constitution, which is the first time they've managed to break from the constitution set up under the Pinochet dictatorship.
Iran's capital, Tehran, has hosted their annual Quran competition. The annual event brings young Quran reciters from across the country to present their Quranic knowledge. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Divine verses are recited by the most euphonious voices here. And the best recitations will win the award of the 44th Quran competition in Iran. 200 contestants are competing in the Quranic event in 2 sections of female and male competitions and in 7 different fields, including recitation, memorization, and interpretation.
Last year, the competition was held online due to pandemic. I'm so happy that this year it's being held physically. I'm competing in recitation section, and I hope I will win the contest.
The Holy Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad some 14 centuries ago to teach humanity how to live in peace. It preaches us against any kind of discrimination and intolerance. So it's good to recite the Quran with a beautiful voice and win a prize here in this contest. But at the same time, we need to pay attention to the divine instructions in order to benefit from this holy book.
The event is organized by the Endowment and Charity Affairs Organization. It says one of the major goals of this competition is to encourage the youth to keep their touch with the holy book of Quran at a time when technology has distracted societies from religious teachings.
The average age of the participants in the contest is below 30 years. This is very promising and shows that previous editions of the competition have been successful in attracting the youth and teens to the Holy Quran and its rich instructions.
The Quranic contest is held at a national scale, but at the same time, it's a preparatory stage for the International Quran Competition, which will be held next year in Iran, where finalists of this event will compete with international contestants.
Every Muslim family has the Holy Quran in their houses to read its verses and ponder its divine messages to mankind. Messages that can leave a deeper impact on listeners through these melodious recitations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
And that is for World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's guidelines on the way of political activities of armed forces and said that he was strongly against involvement of the armed forces in political parties. Thus, he would warn the Iranian armed forces against supporting or opposing any specific political group or establishment. Today, we are going to present you other parts of the Imam's guidelines on the issue.
Thank you.
Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, insistently warned the armed forces against political rivalries due to the fact that it would cause disruption in the structure of the armed forces and would seriously undermine unity of these forces. He writes in his testament, "The very entering a party for the army, the IRGC, the military and police is not permitted. It will lead them to corruption." The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran believed that any involvement of the armed forces in parties or factions would eclipse national interest. He writes, "The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and other armed forces should not enter political affairs so that solidarity is fulfilled. If you enter, you would finally trouble yourselves and would finally stand against one another and would trouble the system and would weaken Islam." Imam Khomeini stressed that every component of the Islamic system should fulfill their own duties without interfering in the affairs of other parts. He writes in another part of his testament, "The duty of every military and garrison is to avoid meddling in the political affairs of the state, because if a soldier enters political affairs, he will lose his duty as a soldier. Thus, the enemies want to cause problems in the core of the army. One of the big problems is to bring political affairs in the army so that they start speaking political words. I order the army commanders that political issues should not be raised in the army." Imam Khomeini, as the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran, emphatically told the parliament and the Supreme Defense Council that they are religiously obligated to prevent the involvement of the military in political affairs. He writes, "Since the revolution belongs to the whole nation and it is everyone's duty to safeguard it, the religious and national duty of the government, the nation, the Defense Council, and the Assembly of Islamic Council or Parliament is to oppose from the very first step. If the armed forces, whether the commanders or the higher and lower ranks, want to do anything against the interests of Islam and the country or enter in parties, which would undoubtedly destroy them. And it is incumbent upon the leader and the leadership council to prevent this issue decisively so that the country is immune from damage." Imam Khomeini was so sensitive toward the involvement of armed forces in political affairs that some paragraphs were inserted in the law of punishment of the armed forces. In a part of the law, it has been made clear that the membership of the military personnel in any party or political organization and group will lead to 6 months to 3 years of imprisonment. Moreover, in the law for presidential election, it reads that the law enforcement forces should do their duties on ballot boxes to keep order, but they should seriously refrain from taking stances for or against any specific candidate. Furthermore, Articles 47 and 48 of the bylaw of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps stress that the IRGC is completely independent from any political party or group and should never find a partisan identity to act as a political party or organization. It stresses that The members of the IRGC have no right to be a member of any political party, group, or organization, and this continuation of membership will cause them to be expelled from the IRGC. Dear listeners, that marks the end of this episode. Next time, we will continue the discussion.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
We did it. Chile's Boric has sealed a leftist revival, as it's been described, with his election win. He's a handful of leftist candidates who have won or are projected to win presidential elections in Latin America. Why is there what appears to be a surge in leftist politicians to have risen in Latin America that has struck such a chord with the citizens of the respective countries? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Chile first, then look at other countries that have had a leftist candidate win appeal to the masses instead of a right-leaning one, like in the Honduras, Peru, Brazil, and Colombia. Well, let's find out what happened in Chile. Alejandra Kirk is our correspondent joining us from Santiago. Well, if the videos were a testament to what really happened, with tens of thousands of people out there on the streets receiving warmly their new president-elect, tell us exactly what has gone down and what Chile is experiencing right now.
Well, hello. Yesterday, 1.2 million new voters went to the polls. That was the decisive factor in Gabriel Boric's victory. These new people were actually Chile has been experiencing a high rate of abstention since vote became voluntary in 2013. This time, after the defeat in the first round of elections, the political leadership of Boric's campaign decided to apply a method used in the past against a digital dirty war by the far-right candidate Casta, which was imposing method of fake news and deviating the debate about personal traits of Gabriel Boric. They went door to door. They raised this slogan, 1 million doors for Boric, and they applied this old technique of popular activism from the 20th century. Local committees, people going door to door, face to face, talking to people, especially the young people, and this yielded this result. 1.2 million people. Boric is not only the youngest ever president of Chile, he's also the most voted ever. And this record is difficult to assess if not for a new way of doing politics. This is a generation change too. This is a break off with the Pinochet legacy. That's how I interpret this. This vote was a plebiscite on whether to continue, not only with the neoliberal policies imposed by the dictatorship and refined after the end of the Pinochet regime, but also with that culture that has been prevailing over the country and which began to be broken by the popular revolt of 2019. There is a constitutional convention working on a new constitution, and Boric has promised to support this work. This constitution should be ready by July, and subject to a plebiscite approve or reject later on. On the political side, this is also a change of style. A young generation, most of them were student leaders of the 2011 student revolt, and they are bringing some fresh air into a system that is has been for a long time too heavy, too formal, too attached to the old habits of politics within four walls. So the promises that Boric has made about structural changes, he also has a moderate program. He's not a communist. He's not a revolutionary. He's promising a social democratic way of changing things, which has raised, of course, many doubts. Many of the people who voted for Boric actually voted against this reinstallation of the Pinochet culture in government represented by this far-right candidate, José Antonio Kast.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We appreciate Alejandro Kirk there, a correspondent from Santiago. Well, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. You're a professor of Latin American and Caribbean Studies, Hostos Community College, Daniel Shaw, who joins us from New York. We also have author, journalist, and contributing editor for The Canada Files, Arnold August, who joins us from Montreal.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Arnold August, let me first start with you. So what do we have over here? I mean, we have this this man, 35 years old, they keep talking about that in the media, who was the reception he had, the number of people who came out to vote for him was unbelievable. What is your initial reaction to how he has won this vote at this point?
Well, first thing, I think that the number of people that came out to vote for him was really outstanding, because the outgoing regime of Piñera did everything to try to hinder the people, especially in Santiago, which is very left-leaning, hinder them from voting by not supplying, as agreed upon, special transportation, special buses to allow people to go to the voting booth. So despite that, he got a very, very strong support and a most important vote for a president in the whole history of Chile. I think that I'm glad that your correspondent in Santiago raised the issue of the context. I just like to underline it, that this election, they took place in the context, especially of the fall 2019, I won't say protests. They were actually consisted of a rebellion, an uprising against a neoliberal order. And the bulk of the people involved in that were the youth. So it was very important that Boric wins that election against someone, Kast, who is a son of a Nazi and also open supporter of fascism. So some people, of course, as your correspondent hinted there, you know, not everyone was so enthusiastic about Boric, because he is not really a left winger. But just imagine today, if Kast would have won, what kind of a conversation will we be having today?
Sure.
And Chile as well, as far as the outcome, how Chile is going further along the path after the elections from yesterday. So it was definitely a historic victory. And with regards to Boric, of course, it's very complicated. He has very good positions domestically, for example, while Kast oppose abortion, of course, Boric supports the right to abortion as well as other increase okay. in social welfare. Yes.
Great. Thank you. Well, let me ask you, if I may, here, Daniel Shaw, to the common person, if you can open this for us, as to what we're talking about when we're talking about a leftist, in which Boris has been described as, and then you talk about the far right, which was what his contender was, I guess, Kast, and then from where you have the previous president come. So as to set the stage for us, what different ideologies are in place here, especially regarding Boris, when he's been described as a leftist?
Good afternoon. We see once again the showdown of this battle of ideas. The son of a Nazi, as the other guest said, far right, Bolsonaro-esque, Trump wannabe, Duterte-esque, neoliberal, in the spirit of Sebastián Piñera, the billionaire president of Chile right now until March when Boric comes into office. Boric, it remains to be seen if who won in Chile is a Bernie Sanders-esque figure, if he's slightly to the right of Bernie Sanders, slightly to the left. I mean, we know for certain this is not a Bolivarian anti-imperialist revolutionary. This is not Rafael Correa. This is not Nicolas Maduro. The first 100 days of Boric's cabinet will be very telling. Already Bloomberg is asking in the Financial Times out of London and all of the stock market analysts who will be selected as his finance minister, who will be his canciller or secretary of state. So they're already toying with the price of international price of copper. So big capital imperialism will flex its muscles if they don't like how Gabriel Boric signals, not just in his first 100 days in 2022, but right now as we speak, he's supposed to be meeting with Sebastián Piñera in a similar way that in 2016, Barack Obama had to sit down with Donald Trump so that they can signal a smooth transition. But a transition for who? For imperialism? For capitalism? For neoliberalism? What type of transition are we talking about?
Sure. Big question there. Well, I'm glad you mentioned how the Wall Street and the financial world of respective institutions even maybe are looking at who he's going to pick for his finance minister. So let me ask you, Arnold August, I mean, didn't they do that with Piñera? I mean, wasn't he a businessman? He received a doctorate in economics from Harvard, and he came into his post 10 years ago. What did that do for the country? Did that actually do well? And more importantly, did the people receive economically the benefits of what his background had as to what we're looking at now with Boric?
Well, with the Piñera administration, and before that, Chile was known as the neoliberal model for all of Latin America. Well, what did it bring? It brought a revolt amongst the young people and also amongst the unions regarding that whole neoliberal outlook. So this, I think, Chile turned a page against that past. But I'd like to raise a thing talking about the pressures that are being exercised by the international media and other countries against Boric. Now, Boric, internationally, he has sort of a mixed bag. On the issue of Israel, he's very good. He says Palestine is an apartheid state and he opposes Israel. But of course, I saw this morning the Israeli newspapers and American newspapers are already screaming, help, no, we can't, the Chileans had no choice but to vote for a pro-Nazi and an Israel basher. So you already see the pressures coming in for him to change his position internationally. Now, he's taken a positive stand with regards to Bolivia. But on the other hand, one has to admit that with regards to Cuba, Venezuela, and Ecuador, he echoes the basic imperialist line against these countries and against these governments. So we have the pressures that will be coming internationally with regards to the makeup of his cabinet, how he's going to approach. Water is very important in Chile, and what will he do with that? And also, at the same time, the pressures internationally try to swing him away from supporting Palestine and supporting Bolivia. He is actually in a very difficult situation. And I hope that he withstands the pressures, not only with regards to Palestine and Bolivia, but also to revert the positions he had taken on Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba, because the best way forward for Chile, based on the experience coming out of the neoliberal experiment, was to forge links with these other countries, their neighbors in Latin America.
Sure.
Which, by the way, Latin America has very close ties with China. This, I think, is the way forward for Chile. And I just hope that this is the option that he takes in the coming weeks and months.
Well, let's look at the bigger picture here, Daniel Shaw. And it was really spread throughout the media back in April 2021 when you had the elections happen in Peru with Pedro Castillo to have, claimed that. And then the news coming out, there's a leftist revival that's happening. It's spreading across Latin America, and it talked about Chile, Colombia, and Brazil, of which we now have seen Chile, to expect this shift to the left. What is going on? Is there a shift to the left? Is there a resurgence of that, I should say?
Yeah, no question. This is the second wave, the second iteration of the pink tie. But notice it's a pink tie. It's not a red tie. A pink tie could still be amenable to imperialism. Imperialism is very astute. The U.S. Embassy and the intelligence services are working overtime. In Chile, in Peru, in Honduras, how can they accommodate their interests to a more left-leaning Pío Maracastro, Pedro Castillo? They will attack diplomatically. They will attack. They could use every trick under their hat. The way it played out in Peru, within 19 days, the canciller, the Secretary of State, Héctor Béjar, was forced to resign. They invented all of these excuses to get rid of this anti-imperialist Minister of Foreign Relations. So when Boric begins his cabinet picks in March of 2022, or slightly before, the Jerusalem Post just published a few hours ago, as Arnold August mentioned there, they're already accusing Boric of being an anti-Semite. But of course, we're not confused that to stand with Palestine is not to be anti-Jewish or to be an anti-Semite. It's to stand for the self-determination of the native people of what's called today the Middle East. So those first 100 days will be telling. We have to go back to 1973 when Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger promised that they would make the Chilean economy scream because Salvador Allende's government dared to be self-determining. So that's what's going to play out in 2022. We certainly hope that there's more of a Bolivarian integration, that these blockades, these genocidal blockades against the Nicaraguan people, against the Cuban people, against the Venezuelan people, that there's room to breathe and that the peoples of Latin America can continue to support one another.
Yeah, and I'm curious as to how this is going to play out, Arnold August, when it comes to OAS. Now, we know the OAS is heavily influenced by the U.S., and it actually has been faulted as such, yes. That it's basically that there's an imbalance there. U.S. initiatives are exercised through the member states, and, of course, the member states, they think that they're enjoying the U.S. support, whether it's financially or what have you. But do you think that the U.S. here is losing that kind of outlook amongst its members when they're seeing how, in general, the public is embracing these leftist politicians, and therefore it makes them think twice?
should we go toe the line with the U.S. or, as you said, stick together with some of these other countries that have moved to the left?
Yes, I think that's a very good point. I agree with you. The OAS is definitely losing any credibility that it may have had. It's no secret that we know that the Secretary General of the OAS, which is, of course, situated in Washington, D.C., was really secretly or not hoping for a victory by a cast over the left-wing candidate. Now, I think it's quite ironic. Now, the overall mainstream media internationally, they're saying that the leftist Boric want the victory. Now, as Danny and I were saying, and yourself as well, you know, how much left he is, you don't really know. But the point is, in my view, it's ironic. By saying that the leftist candidate won, this is good, even if he's not that leftist, because it will encourage two important elections coming up in 2022. One is Brazil, and people in Brazil must say, oh, this is our chance. We want to join this tide of leftist presidents and vote for Lula. And even Colombia, the most important single ally of the United States in that region, elections are taking place there, and now there is a greater possibility that this inspiration coming from Chile, left-wing victory, would also play out in Colombia with the victory of Petro as a progressive candidate against the old line candidates and parties in Colombia. And if this takes place, these two elections take place favorably and 2022, it will be a major important geopolitical change, not only for Latin America, but for all over the world.
Sure.
So we should be hoping for good results in 2022.
Yeah, exactly. And those are the, a couple of the biggest countries there that you mentioned. But Danny Shaw, I'm sure, as you said, the CIA, the U.S. in particular, and perhaps some of the other Western countries allied to the U.S. are looking very closely at this. And, they can't just sit by idly and watch Latin America, these countries, to join forces together and perhaps move as a wall against the U.S. and the world. Not that they're going to cut themselves off, but what types of reactionary moves do you think we'll see from the U.S.? And I'm guessing, and the West maybe, and I'm guessing it's going to be on the economic side, maybe through the IMF and the World Bank, to try to push them on, try to see if they can control these countries. Am I correct to look at it that way?
Yeah, 100%. The hybrid wars are already have been unleashed against the Cuban people, the Venezuelan people, the Bolivian people. We saw the coup in Bolivia over 2 years ago. So they'll use any tactic. It could be through paramilitary outfits. Of course, the financial markets trying to freeze Chile out. And again, as Arnold said, it's too early to forecast that. But if they want to try to bring Chile to their knees, they can cut them off from any type of credit. Bloomberg already announced that the price of copper internationally is down, and they signaled to the other copper producers in the world to produce more. Imperialism is very astute, and imperialism under Biden is arguably much more dangerous. The fox is much more dangerous than the wolf. I mean, Trump was too clumsy, too much of a loose cannon, but a Joe Biden, a Kamala Harris, they can dress themselves up in woke capitalist language. But it's clear that the Latin American peoples are saying, we're no longer your backyard. Not 1824. The Monroe Doctrine is obsolete. And as Arnold mentioned, I mean, the hopes right now of another PT Lula victory in Brazil, of a Petro victory in Colombia. But then there's the revolution, the momentum, the progressive momentum comes in stages, because so far Xiomara Castro is not questioning the U.S. military presence in Honduras. Pedro Castillo is barely surviving. His the media monopolies are attacking him left and right. He hasn't even dared to utter a sentence yet.
Sure.
About the three illegal U.S. military bases in Peru. So we'll see how this class struggle plays out in the very summits of political power in Chile in the upcoming months.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. That was Danny Shaw speaking there, professor of Latin American and Caribbean Studies at Hostos Community College. Thank you so much. And also, Arnold August, thank you, from Montreal, author, journalist, and contributing editor for the Canada Files. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale, my entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, dear believers, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, wherever you are, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to pose and answer some questions and doubts that comes to us on Islamic beliefs. The question that we are going to talk about today is about Salat or prayer. For that, we have invited a respected scholar from Qom Seminary Schools, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, to help us with the answers to the questions that we pose here. Before I pose the question, I'd like to welcome Sheikh Murtada to the show and say salam to him. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure for us, Sheikh, to have you here, and many thanks for accepting the invitation. The question of the day that we want to pose and talk about in this very show is about the consequences of a'mal, or actions of people in this world, based on a hadith and based on our Islamic teachings. We say that if a person does a good thing, Allah will reward him, and if he does bad, he will be punished, he or she will be punished for whatever he did or she did. Now, the question that might come to the minds of the people on such issues is that if an oppressor oppressed a group of people or oppressed a person, let's say, and we are expecting Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to punish him in the day of judgment, so what will be the benefit for the oppressed one in this world, regardless of what will be for him again or her in the other world? So his right or her right, that right of a person who was violated in this world, so does it actually go with the justice of God, the concept of idala of God, that a person is going to be punished in the Day of Judgment in the next world while his right was violated here. So what is a good answer to this question that's what we are going to ask from respected guest speaker of the show, Sheikh Murtada Karim? What can be an answer to this doubt which was posed by a respected listener?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It seems that, some atheists, first of all, they mentioned these doubts and misconception, and they try to claim that there is no benefit for religion and for God.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that they brought about this question was that they wanted to reject the religion altogether and the existence of God.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they say that the punishment for the oppressors on the Day of Judgment has no benefit for the oppressed people. Now, there are a couple of points to be taken into consideration. The first point is that, so if this is the case, if there is no value in punishing the oppressors on the Day of Judgment, and if this is the criterion, what about punishing the people in this world? Imagine a person has killed your father, for example, and now the judge says that the murderer should be imprisoned for a couple of years, according to some Western countries, or let's say even he should be sentenced to death. Now the question is that, what is the benefit of this punishment for your father,
mm-hmm.
who was killed? So if this is the criterion, we can mention that all the punishments which are mentioned by different countries for the criminals, for people who oppress other people, all of them, they are, pointless and fruitless. You are going to imprison a murderer or even execute him, kill him. And now the question arises that what is the benefit for the person who was killed?
Mm-hmm.
He's gone.
Very true.
So whether you punish him or leave him free,
yeah.
there is no benefit for that murdered person. So my point is that this is a wrong understanding of the punishments and rewards. With that criterion, we need to let free all the criminals, because whether we punish them or not, whether we imprison them or not, there won't be any benefit, at least to those people who were killed because of the oppression of these people. There is no benefit for them. So this is a wrong understanding of the philosophy of punishments and rewards.
Very true.
And then the next point is that Islam, I believe, has the best and most complete plan for rewards and actions. When it comes to oppressed people, according to religion of Islam, all the oppressed people will be rewarded by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on the Day of Judgment in accordance with the sufferings that they suffered in this world. If they are believers, not only for oppression, for any kind of trouble that they have gone through in this world. And I think this is the best glad tiding of Islam to the believers. In every moment of their life, even in the most troublesome situations of their life, if they come to this understanding that God will reward them for this calamity, being the, losing dear ones, or, illnesses, or bankruptcy, and so on and so forth. For all these difficulties, of course, if you are patient, if you're not complaining against Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you will be rewarded.
Mm-hmm.
So for the oppressed people, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has, a special reward on the Day of Judgment.
Yes.
And the next point is that, according to the religion of Islam, and I have not seen the same in other religions, punishment and reward is not something separated from the action. according to the religion of Islam,